They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I am constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
On December 8, 2021, the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative hosted a virtual event titled "Can Congress Improve Budget Transparency and Process?" The event featured remarks from Senator James Lankford, followed by an expert panel discussion. The following is the audio from the event. We hope you enjoy.
Good afternoon and welcome to this Article 1 Initiative webinar. Today our theme is "Can Congress Improve Budget Transparency and Process?" It's certainly a timely topic, and we're excited to dive right in. My name is Nate Kazmarek. I am Vice President and Director of Article 1. Per usual, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of our guests. Later, we will introduce our expert panel, but right now we have the pleasure of welcoming Senator James Lankford to our program to kick us off with his own perspective on the matter. Senator Lankford, thank you for carving out some time for us today. How are you?
I'm doing well. Just literally stepped off the floor. We have a vote series going on right now.
All right. Well, I will make it quick. I know that our audience likely knows you very well, but I will supply your background just in case and then hand it over to you for your remarks. Senator Lankford hails from the state of Oklahoma. Before his service in Congress, the senator served students and families for more than 20 years in ministry, including 15 years as director of student ministry for the Baptist Convention of Oklahoma and director of the Falls Creek Youth Camp. He was first elected to Congress in 2010 and served 4 years in the House. He was later elected to the U.S. Senate in 2014. His tenure has been noted by many for his support of lower taxes, limited government, and economic freedom. His current Senate assignments include the Committee on Finance, the Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. He serves there as the ranking member on the Subcommittee on Government Operations and Border Management. He's also on the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources and the Committee on Indian Affairs. In full disclosure, I previously had the privilege of working for Senator Lankford, and while the Federal Society doesn't take any positions on law or public policy, I must say for myself that I know him to be a very good man and a true statesman. With that, Senator, thank you very much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Hey, thank you very much. It's good to be able to see you again, and thanks to Federal Society and the whole Article 1 conversation. It's a conversation well worth having. It's an interesting perspective to say, can Congress improve on the budget process and transparency? The obvious answer to the long webinar is yes. They can. It'd be hard to be able to make things worse than they are, be able to make it more complicated and more detailed. If you think through just this week in the debate about the debt ceiling, and we are the only country in the world that has debt ceilings, that moment is supposed to be a moment to be able to talk about debt and deficit and what are we going to do to get ourselves back on track. It is long past that time. We've had multiple moments of debt ceiling votes where we had moments to say, okay, how are we going to actually deal with debt and deficit? That seems to be waning as a real conversation while the debt continues to accelerate to $29 trillion and counting. We're right now at the middle of December. I'll go ahead and declare it the middle, though some people may say it's in the beginning third, but I'll just declare it right now. We're in the middle of December. We don't have anything done on the appropriations process. September the 30th, which is the end of the fiscal year, we're supposed to have 12 appropriation bills that have passed the House, the Senate, and been conferenced by the House and the Senate, signed by the House and the Senate, a final product, and signed by the President into law by September the 30th. As of September the 30th, only three of the bills had even been heard in the Senate committee at all. The other nine bills hadn't even come up in the Senate committee, much less going back through the process of conferencing with the House and sending over the President. So it was punted from September the 30th all the way until December the 3rd. By the time December the 3rd came, those same nine bills in the Senate had still not even been heard in committee. And the other three bills that had been heard in committee had not been heard on the floor. So everything was punted again until February the 18th, as we continue to be able to watch the delay in the process. Both those moments, we had temporary moments of discussing government shutdowns, everyone's favorite topic, to be able to look on any of the 24-hour news channel and to see the countdown clock working its way through to when we may potentially have a government shutdown again. And then to realize that we didn't have government shutdown, we just had a giant punt again with no resolution and no answers. We've had over the past 40 years, multiple government shutdowns. We've had lots of arguments over debt ceiling. We've had lots of moments where we did not actually get everything done by the end of the fiscal year. It took to the end of the calendar year or on in the continuing resolution process of maintaining last year's budget spending and last year's programs, even though they were only supposed to last a year, but they've now been extended on, creates its own set of problems. I'll never forget about 4 years ago, I sat down with a group of other senators behind closed doors to be able to talk with some people that are members of parliament from different areas around the world and their budget committee and their appropriations folks, and to be able to sit down with them and say, how do you work through some of these as we were bouncing around ideas of what could be done to improve? I asked the question, if you get to the end of your fiscal year and you don't have everything done and you have a government shutdown, what happens at that point? And they all looked at me and said, well, if we don't have our budget work done at the end of the fiscal year, the government collapses and we reform a new government. That's how it works. And it was quiet around the room and all of us looked at each other and said, well, I think that would work as a motivation. And they all said, we don't have government shutdowns because it would cause the collapse of our agreed upon government and parliament. And they would just bring in new folks that would actually get the job done at that point. The reason I bring that up is we're very unique in this and how we deal with it. We've had a structured process since 1974, the 1974 Budget Act, that was supposed to put in this very simple process to be able to get appropriations authorization done. But what it's actually created is an incredibly complicated process for the last several years. We've seen only four times since 1974 for the Budget Act to work exactly as it was designed to be able to work. So what do we do about it? Let me give you just a couple of ideas and thoughts. I have a bill that deals with ending government shutdowns. One of the reforms that needs to be in place is to take the idea of government shutdowns off the table. Government shutdowns creates chaos in the federal workforce, creates all kinds of additional deficit spending because agencies have to spend time away from their normal tasks, actually working on how they're going to actually shut down, who's going to be essential, who's non-essential, how they get restarted. Federal workers are always paid. Contractors are seldom paid when it's said and done. So the contractors are the ones who have the biggest hit in the process. And it's chaotic as people are trying to get permits and anything else they can try to get with the federal government. Ending government shutdowns takes an issue off the table that if we don't vote for this bad bill, we're going to have a government shutdown. And it puts the pressure back on where we should be. And that is, we should be debating the debt and deficit issues. So Senator Maggie Hassan, Democrat senator from New Hampshire, she and I came up with a concept a couple of years ago. That's a very simple, straightforward concept that we have wide bipartisan support for. That is, we get to the end of the fiscal year, whatever moment that is, and the 12 appropriation bills are not done. We don't have a government shutdown. We have a 2-week continuing resolution that automatically renews itself. But in the meantime, the Senate in particular can't move to any other item of business other than appropriations bills. We're in session 7 days a week with a mandatory quorum call every single day at noon. And all travel abilities, all reimbursement for travel goes away. What does this mean? If we don't have our appropriations work done by the end of the fiscal year, that means we have to stay until it actually gets done. That's the only thing that's there. I've had folks say, cut the work, cut the pay of members of Congress, and they'll get the work done. And I typically will smile at them and say, I'd like to introduce you to some of the multimillionaires that I serve with. Honestly, I can name names, and so can you, of people that don't really think about their congressional pay as being an impact. It's a rounding error their congressional pay is based on what their investment portfolio is. Nothing against them one way or the other. I just don't think pay is going to be a motivation. Time is a motivation. If you take away members of Congress, their time, and you lock everybody in and say, we're not going to move to other items and can't move to other items, and we're going to be here every weekend. No Codells, no traveling to see people at home, no going to campaign, no anything else. We're here during this time period. It's a very strong motivator to get on target and to be able to get it done. This bill has wide bipartisan support. It is one of many simple things that we have that we're working through the process to be able to fix things like the fiscal year, the calendar date, all sorts of other things that, that are problems of the 1974 Budget Act. But first things first, we've got to solve this issue of government shutdowns. and a ticket off the table. Second thing is something we've actually already passed. It's called the Taxpayer's Right to Know. If you ask anyone at the Office of Management and Budget or anyone that's in Congress and say, where do we have duplication in government? It's a big common theme. Where do we have duplication in government? They'll say, well, you need to go to GAO, ask them to research it. GAO will then tell you it'll take 3 to 6 months to be able to research a particular area where we have duplication in government. And 3 to 6 months from now, they'll bring it back to you and say, here's where the basically the same thing is being done in multiple different agencies. That is absurd. The federal government's the only place in all of the United States that you can't go and say, tell me what you do, how many people are assigned to actually do it, and how you evaluate the quality of that work. If you go to any business operation, they can tell you what they do, how many people actually work on that project, and how it's actually evaluated, but that doesn't exist in the federal government. In fact, quite frankly, there is no list of even all programs that are done in the federal government. We don't have a list of programs. We have multiple lists of programs, and they're all different in their definition, how they operate. So I worked for several years to get a bill passed called the Taxpayer's Right to Know that actually lays out a consistent definition of programs across all agencies so we can have a master list of programs that's fully searchable that you can determine what do we do, how many people are assigned to actually accomplish that purpose, and if it's evaluated, how is it evaluated? The reason that's so important is it gives the taxpayer the opportunity to be able to do a quick search online to be able to say, how many different job training programs do we have? How many different construction programs? How many green energy programs are out there? What do we do across all of the federal government on this particular issue? And it allows members of Congress to then be able to look at it and say, why do we have 14 programs on this with 14 different sets of HR, 14 different sets of administrative work? Some of them are evaluated, some of them are not. Some of them seem to be successful, and some seem to be just a title. Some of these just organically grow up over time. Some of them are intentional. So the goal of this is that we'll actually be able to see all programs that are in the federal government to be able to find areas of duplication, not with a 3 to 6 month search from GAO, but a 3 to 6 second internet search, and then to be able to determine what do we do about that. That bill has already passed. It passed last year. It's in the process of being implemented. GAO has actually identified it as one of their number one priorities to be able to track the implementation, but it will take a solid 5 years for the federal government to be able to form a definition of all areas for every program and then to start to be able to lay that out. It is a budget reform that we've talked about for a while that's actually working to be able to get in process. So as you have discussion today about what could Congress do, there's always this attitude of Congress will never do anything. That's not true. If we stay at it and we work at some of these issues, most of these issues are not partisan. The solution to how to resolve them may be partisan, but everyone sees the problem with the budget issues. It's just what's the best way to actually resolve this, and then how do we actually get those things passed? It took almost 10 years to get the Taxpayer's Right to Know passed into law. Now it's being implemented. Some of these other ideas, we need to just be able to latch on to be able to work until they actually get done. And then we'll see them actually get implemented over the years ahead. So if I can quote a biblical example, those that are doing good shouldn't grow weary in doing what's right. And there's a lot of things that need to be done in this process. So thanks for inviting me to be able to set some of this dialogue up. I look forward to hearing some of the conversation and some of the notes that come out of this kind of conversation about how do we reform the budget process.
Well, thank you very much, Senator. I know you have a tight schedule, so we will let you go, but we'd certainly love to have you back again with us soon. And you've definitely given us a lot to discuss with our panel. So thank you and have a great day. Turning to our panel now, we are once again happy to have the knowledgeable guidance of Ilya Shapiro to moderate this discussion. Ilya is a vice president of the Cato Institute. He directs the Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies and publishes the Cato Supreme Court Review. Before joining Cato, he was a special assistant advisor to the multinational force in Iraq on rule of law issues and practiced at Patton Boggs and Cleary Gottlieb. If you'd like to learn more about all of our guests today, you can visit our website, regproject.org, where we have complete bios. In a moment, I will turn it over to Ilya. Once our panel has had ample time to debate and discuss our topic, we'll go to audience Q&A. So please think about the questions you'd like to ask them. Audience questions can be submitted via Zoom, via the raised hand function. If you raise your hand, we'll do our best to call on everyone in order. With that, Ilya, I turn it over to you.
Great. Thanks very much, Nate, and thanks to the Federalist Society's Article One project. I'm a big fan of Article One. I think Congress should have a lot more power, which might seem odd coming from someone at Cato, but I'm not saying in the absolute that the federal government needs power, but it just needs to be rebalanced among the branches. But even more noteworthy than that, you heard Senator Lankford suggest a constitutional amendment to dissolve Congress for new elections when appropriations aren't done. So we'll see where that goes. Well, look, you're not here to necessarily, some of you maybe, to listen to me make jokes of dubious constitutional and budgeting intent, but there are experts that argue that the first and most important place for congressional reform is the power of the purse. That's why we're discussing this today. With regular order a distant memory, annual budgeting proceedings failing to live up to the basic framework of the 1974 Budget Act, the ever-expanding role of the president in spending, and regular threats of shutdowns, some fear the legislative branch has lost its ability to oversee and control our nation's finances. So our panel of experts, whom I'll introduce shortly, will discuss their ideas for fixing this, as well as Senator Lankford's proposals and much more. I'll introduce them all now and then turn it over. Bill Hoagland is a bipartisan Policy Center senior vice president, helping direct fiscal, health, and economic policy analysis. Before joining BPC, he served as vice president of public policy for Cigna Corp and spent 33 years in the federal government, including as the director of budget and appropriations in the office of Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, for whom I interned nearly 25 years ago, actually. And Bill Hoagland participated in negotiations over, just about every important budgeting legislation in the last 30 years or so. And he was even one of the first employees of the Congressional Budget Office working for its first director, Alice Rivlin. I will post his latest a relevant op-ed that he wrote earlier this year in The Hill called Reconciliation Corrupted by Politics, May It Rest in Peace. And as I said, I'll introduce all of them. So after Bill will be Matt Lawrence, who's an associate professor of law at Emory University, where he researches healthcare finance and administrative law. In addition to teaching and scholarship, he also has a wealth of federal government experience, most recently as special legal advisor to the House Budget Committee. He's also worked at OMB and the Justice Department's Federal Program Branch. And he has a timely Law Review article arguing against Chevron deference for permanent appropriations. I will now post that in the chat. I was just reminded that our order has switched. That's right. Well, anyway, I'll introduce them all so you'll have their backgrounds, but I guess their order will be reversed in how I'm introducing them. So take that for what you will. And our third person I'll introduce third will actually be our first speaker, and that's Molly Reynolds, who's a senior fellow in governance studies at Brookings. She studies Congress with an emphasis on how congressional rules and procedure affect domestic policy outcomes. She's the author of the book, Exceptions to the Rule, The Politics of Filibuster Limitations in the U.S. Senate. So very, you know, it's a book which you don't think is necessarily ripped from the headlines. But of course, right now we're arguing about reconciliation and, you know, avoiding the filibuster for these kinds of budgeting issues. She's also taught at George Mason University and testified before Congress on the budgeting process earlier this year, from which she condensed a long blog post at Lawfare called Reforming Congress's Power of the Purse, which I will post as well. And while I'm doing that, I'm happy to turn it over to Molly to begin our discussion.
All right, thank you. And thanks to everyone who has joined us today. So my job today is to start off our conversation with some sort of general kind of 30,000 foot view observations on why we need a budget process reform of the kind that the Senator has talked about, and I think other folks are going to talk about today. And I'm going to start by just sort of underlining the fact that the separation of powers system in the United States, in addition to meaning that the government does not collapse when appropriations are not successfully passed by the start of the fiscal year, also means that Congress legislates and the executive branch implements, and that arrangement generates inevitable slippage between what Congress intends and then what actually happens. This is inevitable. Beyond this inevitable slippage, there are reasons why Congress might prefer to give authority to the executive branch, either because the executive branch has capacities Congress doesn't, because Congress prefers to let the executive branch make hard choices. But regardless of sort of why the executive branch has the power it does, and importantly, regardless of the partisan balance of control between Congress and the executive branch, Congress needs institutionally ways to monitor this slippage. The next thing I'll note is that if we look at congressional history, we see that Congress's usual course of action is to respond to changes in executive branch behavior with its own procedural innovations. We saw this with the original passage of the Anti-Deficiency Act and its requirement that Congress apportion funds as a way to prevent the executive branch from spending down what Congress has allocated to it too quickly. The Congressional Budget Act was in part a similar move, pushing back against the president's assertion of things like rescission and deferral power. There are, importantly, these presidential powers in the budget process are statutory. So if Congress felt compelled to direct the president to apportion appropriated funds for obligation, it should also now, today, feel comfortable periodically revising its approach to ensuring that apportionment is happening in the way that it intends. The next kind of point that I'll make is that as the senator indicated, changes in the nature of the legislative process more generally have made procedural reforms to the budget process necessary. So Congress, as we know, routinely relies on continuing resolutions and shut down brinkmanship to and as a result, it's more difficult for Congress to credibly threaten to withhold funding for a specific executive branch priority. When there is a partial shutdown of federal operations, the executive branch, as we know, has substantial discretion over exactly which activities cease and which ones can continue under exceptions to the Anti-Deficiency Act's prohibitions on obligating funds in the absence of appropriations. The unlikelihood of sort of a full course correction, to regular order only adds to the need for change. And then the last thing that I will note is that the erosion of Congress's oversight power and the increasing reliance on of Congress on the courts as an enforcer of oversight efforts suggests that Congress really would be well served to strengthen its hand as it seeks information from the executive branch. The senator talked about sort of GAO's capacities, both in the context of the Taxpayers' Right to Know Act and more generally. But I think this is a really, again, a really important element of thinking about budget process reform in the broader context of Congress's capacities and Congress's power. So I will stop there, and then I believe I'm going to turn it to Matt next.
Thank you, Dr. Reynolds, and thanks everyone for joining this webinar. There's been a lot of talk so far already about problems, and there's certainly a sense of problems with our budget process and budget execution in the United States. And you don't hear a lot of cheering for shutdowns and debt ceilings and the constant dysfunction in Congress. And to disaggregate a bit, as a law professor, kind of four components of the problem you hear about are just a feeling of a loss of control. We can't control where our country is going. Often a use of hostage taking or kind of cannibalism as a means of governing that will threaten with a shutdown and that's how we'll get things done, or we'll cut their salaries and that's how we'll get things done. The fact that in a lot of ways, when it comes to spending, we're violating the intent of the framers. The framers were very concerned with keeping congressional control over spending. And in many domains, we have a lot of executive discretion that is not checked by either Congress or sometimes by the executive. And then fourth, I'll add in, the current way we do things is sort of inherently controversial. Whether or not funds should be reprogrammed for the wall or not, whether or not we should fund a bridge in a particular place, if we do it in a secretive fashion that's not through the lawmaking process, there are going to be people pointing fingers, and it's going to be hard for even the good guys who did things the right way to show everyone and build trust. And that's kind of an inherent issue with that kind of discretionary approach. So we get solutions, and we heard a couple of solutions proposed. And really, my core thing I'd like to pull apart is to say there's four dimensions that you need to think about or that are important to think about in evaluating solutions. The first dimension is the political implications, and I'll put that aside. I think we can all think about that, and many of you probably much better than I can. The second dimension is the fiscal policy implications. So fiscal policy, I mean, our system as a country for making trade-offs between taxing and spending and borrowing, and how are we going to take our resources as a country and where are we going to devote them and how will we do that? That's kind of fiscal policy big picture. And a lot of the choices in this space impact our fiscal policy choices. And so, for example, there's this bill, proposed bill, End Shutdowns Act, and it would say if there's no funding at the end of a year, instead of a shutdown, you just get continued funding at the same amount for 90 days, and then there's a 1% reduction for 90 days, and then there's a 1% reduction. And that has fiscal policy implications because it will, over time, kind of load the dice towards the reductions in spending, right? You could imagine flipping it and having after 90 days, there's a 1% increase in taxes or something. That would have fiscal policy implications. And I'm not saying what should be done right now. I'm just saying that's a dimension, the fiscal policy dimension. A third dimension is the substantive policy dimension. The particular program, the Indian Health Service and how it should run, is also tied up in these questions, again, with a shutdown. Currently, if we shut down the government, the Indian Health Service, which people rely on for their healthcare, is disrupted. And it's hard to make a policy case for that. You can make a policy case for or against an entitlement, but if you have an entitlement, it's hard to make a case that it should just be disrupted because of a shutdown. So there's a substantive policy balance. And if you, let's say, had automatic funding, like that proposal to automatically fund the government, that would insulate people who rely on programs like that from the risk of a shutdown. That's good from a substantive policy perspective. Anyway, that's the third dimension, substantive policy. And then the fourth dimension, the dimension Madison would be thinking about, is power, okay? We can assume that everyone involved is going to be doing things for fiscal policy or substantive policy, but people are going to be thinking about power. And what you do with appropriations and shutdowns or anything in the space often profoundly influences who has power over what. Shutdowns in particular, the power to shut down gives unilateral authority to a simple majority in the House of Representatives, or maybe even sometimes a minority in the Senate, to shut down the government. And so in 2018, you see Democrats, they win the House of Representatives, they have power because of the power to shut down. And then in 2022 or 2024, 2026, we may see different parties, you know, with a simple majority with the power to shut down. There again, the power implications are really important. If you automatically fund the government, if there's no appropriations, then you take away that power from the simple majority. And there's a really important implication. We don't have time to get into everything, but my core thing I want to communicate is just that I think it's really valuable to separate and think about those dimensions. The political dimension, yes, but also the fiscal policy, the substantive policy, and the power implications. And they all interact and are sometimes in tension, and they're what makes it both hard to solve some of these problems and really important to have webinars like this and to think deeply about it. And if I can kind of close with just two little points. First, subtext of all of this, the balance of powers is not just about the Supreme Court. In fact, the headlines every day, reconciliation, debt ceiling shutdowns, These, as Dr. Reynolds said, are creatures of statute or rules or the parliamentarians' processes in the Senate or something like that. Where the action is in terms of the actual functioning of our government is often these rules, laws, norms, which is both confusing but also empowering for voters or Senate staffers or anyone, because it means you don't have to wait for the Supreme Court and see what it does on Chevron to change the way our government works. There's opportunities right there in front of us. And then the second thing I'll close with, and I'll truly close here because Ilya may be getting nervous, is that it's valuable to look for reforms that sort of control for one dimension that I talked about. So for example, look for, if you're concerned with fiscal policy, are there fiscal policy reforms that aren't taking a substantive stance or aren't interfering with the balance of powers? And Senator Lankford discussing earlier about punishing Congress for a shutdown with time, that's interesting because it controls away substantive impacts and things like that. So that's something to think about. There's a bill going through the House of Representatives right now, the Protect Our Democracy Act, that has a bunch of measures that are trying to focus not on the kind of fiscal policy, but on the power side, on the power the presidency has because of all the discretion it has to control spending today. And it has a number of things: publication of OLC opinions, more GAO authority to overview spending decisions, apportionment transparency. Apportionments are tools OMB has to alter when spending happens and how it happens, and just promoting transparency and congressional control in those areas. That's an effort to isolate that power variable and pull some power back towards Congress's direction that is very intriguing. So there I will stop, but look forward to further conversation.
Good afternoon. It's hard to follow Professor Lawrence and Dr. Reynolds as a former Senate staffer, but first of all, I want to congratulate the Federalist Society and your Article One initiative. As a longtime former Senate Budget Committee staffer, I particularly like the mission of restoring Congress in its rightful place in the constitutional order. And now that I'm at the Bipartisan Policy Center, I like the idea, also impressed by it, that the initiative is nonpartisan, trying to bring together both Republicans and Democrats, right and left, in dealing with these issues. I have some thoughts about, I want to focus on something called the Power of the Purse Act, but on the basis of what Senator Lankford said, I just want to make a couple of quick observations from my own perspective. And number one is, as Dr. Reynolds Molly knows, one of the former CBO directors early on, Rudy Pinner, liked to say the process is not the problem, the problem is the problem. And I just want to reemphasize, it's the political will. I've been fortunate or unfortunate to have spent my career working with the Congressional Budget Office, beginning with the Congressional Budget Office through 17 of the 21 reconciliation bills that have become law. I've gone through Graham Rudman Hollings. I've gone through CAPS. I'm probably part of the problem myself by having created so many different kind of mechanisms and mousetraps to try to do something with fiscal policy. But at the end of the day, I keep coming back to the fact that if there is no will there, there is not going to be any real effort to deal, which I think is most important. I still believe deficits matter and debt matters. And we obviously have, as Senator Lankford said, have that's no longer the key issue. On two quick issues before talking about the Power of the Purse Act, I would note that I am totally in support of what Professor Lawrence has said and what Senator Lankford has said is about the continuing resolution, an act for continuing resolution. My preference personally would be a continuing resolution that says after those 10, 15, 13 days, whatever, that it's an automatic CR, but a reduction of 2% in spending. At some point that becomes, I like the idea maybe Matt, Professor Lawrence about maybe flipping that and making a tax increase, but something that provides that pressure. But I agree, doing away with any opportunity for a government shutdown, automatic, whatever it be. I'm more always worried about, and we are dealing with it right now, the issue associated with the debt limit. I think that is, Senator Lankford pointed out, that is, we are the only country in the world that has this kind of a situation. if I had my preferences, I would probably say just do away with it. We've incurred the debt. We've incurred the spending. It's there. Just pay your bills. That's not going to happen. Over the years, it has become the tool and the leverage for trying to do certain fiscal policies. But I have a proposal goes along with that. When Congress adopts a budget resolution, and here's the budget resolution for this that they're working on right now. Literally on page 6, you will find that the statute that the number for the statutory debt limit is 30.8 trillion. I don't understand this issue. You voted for it. You voted for the number. Go ahead and automatically kick out the debt limit once you adopt a congressional budget resolution, because you'll have to put the debt limit number in that resolution. As it relates to the Power of the Purse Act, I want to emphasize something that Molly mentioned earlier, and she had some testimony before Congress earlier this year, and it has to do with the structure of the U.S. constitutional system, where it is always true, it's been true, that situations will be encountered where the legislative language is unclear, and those charged with administering the law will not have sufficient guidance. I have no proof of this. I'll leave it to the professor and to Molly, who are much more adept at this than I am looking at it. But I think this is a problem that has grown over the years, as the issues that we have to deal with are a lot more complex, technology has advanced, and quite frankly, members of Congress wanting to claim that they've accomplished something rushed through legislation with limited or even biased input from lobbyists or lack of technical expertise from a very stretched and limited staff. Maybe the need, and I know the oversight, Ilya, the focus here with the Federalist Society is on oversight. Maybe the need for legislative oversight could be at least lessened if we spent more time in actually improving our legislating. And so I support the thrust of the act. I don't think the focus can only be, however, just on the executive branch. I think it needs to also focus on the legislative branch and improving the legislative branch, and particularly the Office of Technology Assessment, maybe bringing that back in and restructuring the committee's areas of jurisdiction. I'll had a couple of other comments here. I know we're limited on time, so I will just limit my comments to just a couple of last points here. I strongly support the provision that would provide a requirement that the budget authority proposed for rescission or deferral be made available in time to be obligated or de-obligated. I honestly think President Trump's deferral of security assistance to the Ukraine in 2019 was really a rescission. And in fact, in this language that's in this act, it would actually prevent some of those kind of games going. I would note, however, that nothing, if GAO did rule that it was a violation of the Impoundment Control Act, but I don't think anybody was suffered because of the ruling. And that's my second point I would want to make about the proposals that are in the Power of the Purse Act. And that is, there's a lot of discussion about penalties. If my memory serves me correct, and Molly can correct me, I'm sure, only once in the nearly 50-year history of the Impoundment Control Act has there been even any real penalty established, 50 years, and no action. And I personally would like to see the penalties much stronger. I am not a lawyer. I realize I'm speaking to lawyers, but if I am correct, even in the simple white crime of fraud, jail time could be a sentence of 1 to 5 years, and in a felony embezzlement case, anywhere from 1 to 30 years. It just seems to me that federal employees, whether they be political or career, should face similar sentences if they violate the taxpayers' trust in the management of the federal purse. Those are some of the comments that I wanted to get on the table. I know you want to leave time for questions, Ilya, so I'll leave my comments about emergency funding, which is also a major concern I have we can talk about. Thanks.
Wonderful. Now I have my own question, and the audience has already started putting theirs in the chat. You can also raise your hand eventually when I open it up I'll call on you to ask your question directly, or you can put it in the chat. But before that, I'd like to invite either Dr. Reynolds or Professor Lawrence to follow up on issues that have been laid on the table.
So I, the one thing that I'll say is I just want to sort of underline some of what Professor Lawrence was saying about the different levers that we're talking about when we make process changes. And I'll say that I am not someone who's especially a fan of the sort of automatic continuing resolutions to prevent shutdowns. I think that would not be my preferred way to try and prevent the uncertainty that comes with a potential government shutdown. One thing that I do appreciate about Senator Lankford's proposal with Senator Hassan is it really takes seriously the incentives that members of Congress face, and it really tries to alter their behavior by altering the incentives that they face. So make it less, not just not cut off their pay, but makes it a lot less pleasant for them to do their jobs in the immediate aftermath of missing a fiscal year deadline. And so I think that as we, again, think big picture here, as we think about the big forces that are at play, I think that's really important to remember.
And I'll just add to that, because I'm curious to get to the Q&A and everything. First, on that big picture, one dimension, when we get to substantive policy or fiscal policy, there's then a set of questions about who pays. And one big problem with shutdowns is that today they're very unfair in terms of who winds up paying the cost of shutdowns. When there's a shutdown, I'm not a federal employee right now. I'm pretty insulated, so I can watch and I can kind of judge that it's happening, but I'm not affected. But people who rely on programs that need appropriations are very severely impacted. And so that's not necessarily the framers' idea that the separation of power should be fueled on the backs of people who rely on annual appropriations. And that's part of why when I suggest if there were a penalty when you have the automatic continuing resolution, if there were a tax hike, one benefit of that is that's a more generalized cost that would maybe that hopefully never happen. And then I just want to say too, Bill mentioned about penalties in the Empowerment Control Act or the Anti-Deficiency Act, the statutes that are on the books that constrain the executive, but there's a huge question of are they enforced and how are they enforced? And well, is there a penalty for not following them? We could talk more about that because this is a rare area where the executive does most of the interpreting of its own rules. So this isn't an area where courts are coming in or even Congress necessarily. It's often the executive is policing its own rules. And the only thing I'll add is another dimension is the dynamic between career staff and political appointees. And there's a sense in which penalty can be a protection for career staff because they can tell a political appointee, hey, not only is this a rule, but I face consequences if I don't follow it. Whereas if there's no penalties at all and people, you know, you don't have that same kind of protection. And so it may be easier for that occasional political appointee who is not doing their best to follow the rules to do some damage. But I really do look forward to the Q&A.
Well, one thing before we get to audience questions, I'm not a budget guy. I'm a simple constitutional lawyer, and I'm wondering. I think probably others on the call or who will be watching the recording are wondering: is can we talk a little bit more about how things broke down and why they broke down? Is it simply a tale of political polarization that the parties are more polarized? Our whole political discourse is more ideologically sorted and it's harder to compromise. The dynamic has to be different here than for some issue areas because everybody seems to like to spend money, just different priorities, I suppose. But why the breakdown in regular order? What is regular order for that matter? We talk about it a lot and is it just having separate appropriations bills? Is it a breakdown in Senate rules or House rules or what have you? How have we gotten to where we are before we even start talking about these reforms?
Yeah, so I think different folks will have different answers to this, but I will emphasize some both direct and indirect consequences of polarization for the breakdown in the budget process. So I think the most direct consequence of polarization for the breakdown of the budget process is that as the parties have gotten farther apart and it has gotten more difficult to overcome the now increasingly routine 60 vote threshold in the Senate, it has become more attractive to do things in one large omnibus bill because as the thinking goes, it's easier to log roll across issues. It's easier to have to build one coalition rather than have to build 12 separate coalitions. So that's sort of a direct consequence of polarization that I see as having led in part to where we are. And then a really, to me, important indirect consequence is the fact that as polarization and hyperpartisanship and partisan conflict have made it more difficult to legislate on other issues, the appropriations process has come to bear more of the political conflict that used to be spread across more legislative issues. So because we have the prospect of a government shutdown as this really sort of severe penalty if Congress doesn't act on at least a continuing resolution by the start of the new fiscal year or whatever subsequent deadline gets set, that makes that sort of gives appropriations bills in omnibus form or CRs, gives them a must-pass status, but then it makes them attractive places to fight out political fights that in this, you know, 30 years ago might have been hashed out on other bills that were also coming to the floor. So that's to me a kind of less direct but still important consequence of polarization and partisanship in Congress. But I'd be curious what the other panelists think.
I have a couple of quick observations. And number one, just from experience, I think the Congressional Budget Impairment Control Act was working pretty good until about the middle of the 1990s. And then, as you'll recall, we had some major conflicts between Republican-controlled Congress and President Clinton. We had, we had the longest government shutdown in history in the winter of 1995-1996. I remember it well. It was over the holidays. It was over the Statue of Liberty was shut down. Holiday visitors to New York City couldn't go to the Statue of Liberty or our national parks were closed. Anyway, we worked that out. We had to go. Maybe that was the benefit of a shutdown. We actually had to work together. We came back. President, as we're honoring him this week, Senator Dole gave up his position as a majority leader and said, "I'll run for president. We'll take this to the American public." He lost, of course, and President Clinton had a second term. But we came back after that, 1997, and passed, said, buried the hatchet, so to speak, and we ended up basically passing a congressional budget or the Balanced Budget Act of 1997 that put us on a path. Now, there were other things that were going on. The economy was booming pretty well along there, but we actually ended up with a surplus. And the reason I go through this is where I think things got a little bit off mark. If you can believe it, we had a surplus as far as the eye could see. The incoming Bush administration in 2001 was looking at a surplus of nearly $7 trillion. That was not just the incoming Bush administration, it was the outgoing Clinton administration, the wannabe Gore administration, the Alan Greenspan Federal Reserve, the CBO, all were projecting that. And so that incoming Bush administration in 2001 said, let's return some of that to the American public in the form of a tax cut. And we had a 50-50 Senate, remember? A 50-50 Senate in 2001. But there was an agreement to go ahead and return some of that surplus to the American public in the form of a tax cut, not to create a deficit, but to actually return it through the use of, at that time, reconciliation to make a tax cut. It was implemented and passed it both in a, even with a, we had Democratic support for it in the United States Senate. And it became law in June, July of 2001. We know what happened in September of 2001, and the deficits occurred. Following that time frame, we ended up with a pox on both houses, so to speak. Some people say, well, you had the Affordable Care Act. Obama's Obamacare Act became law. It was not done under reconciliation. It was passed the United States Senate with 60 votes when there were 60 Democratic senators to support it. And it went basically straight to the president because of the House could not make amendments to it because there was a special election in Massachusetts to replace the former Senator Ted Kennedy. I say that because then when we come back with the Trump administration, it says, let's do tax, if we can do tax cuts, let's use reconciliation again, even though we were facing a deficit. And that then set up the process for the current administration and the Biden administration to say, well, if you can use tax cuts, you can use reconciliation for tax cuts, why can't you use the reconciliation for spending increases? So I think we've gone off the rail, so to speak, by using this particular process for things that should never have been intended for. In fact, I have a letter that I carry around with me from 2009. Dear colleagues, I oppose the use of budget reconciliation for the purposes of passing healthcare reform, climate change legislation. It goes on. It was signed by one of the authors of the Congressional Budget Power and Control Act, Robert C. Byrd. He and others who, this was not the way it was intended. And I'm afraid to answer your question, I don't have a straight answer to you, but it has just gone off the mark completely from what it was originally intended to do.
Go ahead.
Those are all fascinating answers, and I can't give a better one, but I can give a different perspective as a simple law professor. We tend to focus on the big structural questions, which the actual impacts may be indeterminate, but I would point at perhaps to some extent the administrative state and to the Supreme Court's decision in INS v. Chadha. So as a response to a lot of changes in this country in the 1930s and 40s, as viewers are familiar, we have the New Deal and we have a tremendous growth in federal power. And what's happening is Congress is writing laws that are giving its powers to agencies, right? That's delegation, that's the whole deal. As Congress does that, about 200 times over the next 50 years, it puts a leash in, it puts a string in, it says legislative veto. We're giving you this massive power, but one house can take it back, or maybe both houses or something like that. And that preserves a kind of a majoritarian check on the administrative state and on all of those statutes. In comes the Supreme Court in INS v. Chadha, and it says, one, the legislative veto is unconstitutional. You cannot have a one house unilateral check. And two, all those 200 statutes that you wrote where you kept that leash, we're just cutting the leashes. So we're taking legislative veto out of it and the agencies just have the power. And the National Emergencies Act, for example, that's a statute people point at, the broad power of the executive, had a legislative veto in it until the Supreme Court took it out. So then what happens? So wave one of the Congress trying to scramble to get continuing majoritarian power over the administrative state. Wave one, you get the legislative veto. Wave two, after the 1980s, 90s, and to today, you see appropriations, you see the debt ceiling, you see this kind of fiscal spending tool as a way to try to get power over the administrative state. But that causes a lot of problems because it monkeys with other things. And to the extent that structural kind of determinant is what's at play, it tees up the question, what do we do next? How do we rethink the way Congress exerts power over the administrative state so that it does not simultaneously mess with our fiscal policy, the way we decide about substantive policy and so on. So I wouldn't, as a law professor, say that explanation is more correct or all that correct as compared to the historical and political explanations you heard, but it is at play, I think, in this overarching dynamic we see over the decades.
Before we get to the audience questions, a follow-up to all of that, Bill raised the the shutdown of 95-96, the longest one we've had, the 50-50 Senate that we've had before. We've had more polarization since then, but we've had these bumps in the road. It's not the same tale as when you're talking about kind of the one-way ratchet for judicial confirmation, say, of tit-for-tat escalations. So is the polarization and kind of the partisan politics, you know, the whole story, in which case all of these reform proposals that whether Senator Lankford or others are bandying about are just addressing symptoms rather than the roots of the problem, which can't be addressed simply, or are these reform efforts really able to supersede the challenges of a polarized or more partisan era?
So I think one thing that's important to keep in mind is that we have some moments in recent history where we have seen parts of the process work better than we would expect. And they've been moments that have kind of taken at first principles the idea that we live right now and are legislating in a very polarized environment. So one of the sort of great ironies of the 2018-2019 record length government shutdown is that it was a partial government shutdown, not in the way that we sort of use the term partial government shutdown to mean that some operations continue because they are accepted and some of them cease, but because there were, I believe, five agencies whose appropriations actually were passed before the start of the new fiscal year on October 1st. And those included both the Department of Defense and the Departments of Health and Human Services, Labor and Education, which are the two largest discretionary appropriations bills. And that happened in part because earlier in 2018, Congress said, we're gonna put those two bills together, these two big discretionary bills that have things in them that are very important to both Republicans and Democrats alike. And we're gonna bring them to the floor together. And we're gonna just sort of link those issues and try to leverage that into getting something done before the deadline. And so I think, my overall point here is that there, I think, are opportunities for change and reform at this moment, but the ones that are most likely to be successful are ones that take the underlying politics seriously.
All right. If no one else has something on that, let's go to the audience questions. And again, I'll remind everyone, you can raise your hand on the Zoom, so virtually raise your hand, or you can type questions into the chat. So, Saren asks, can you explain a little more what apportionment transparency is and how making apportionments public would help Congress and the public conduct better oversight of spending? I'll add a kind of potentially contravening corollary in that, would smoke-filled rooms and less transparency help the process?
So I'm happy to speak to that. Once Congress appropriates funds for an agency to spend, there's a risk that the agency will take the funds and say, thanks for those for the year. I'm going to spend them all this month. And then because I spent them all this month, I'll come to you next month and I'll say, I have to shut down unless you give me more money. And then the Congress will be basically forced to give more money. There's a couple of ways that the fiscal laws address that. One is the Anti-Deficiency Act, but another is the authority of the president and the Office of Management and Budget to apportion funds, which means you have an appropriation for the year, but here's how much you should kind of get every month over the course of the year so that you don't spend it all in one place. That's the authority that is on the books, and it's permitted by the Impoundment Control Act. But over time, we've seen the growth of the unitary executive and presidential administration, where we don't just have the agencies, but we have the White House and the presidency influencing what the agencies do. So instead of the Secretary of Transportation deciding how to spend the money, OMB might have influence over that. And OMB has used apportionment as a tool of influence, not to say here's how much you spend each month, but actually don't spend until we decide whether it's okay, or here it is what that it's okay for you to spend on, and things like that. And it currently is able to do that through these apportionments and apportionment footnotes, these instructions, without any transparency. Nobody knows that it's necessarily doing that. Committees of Congress may know, the public doesn't necessarily know. GAO could perhaps ask on a case-by-case basis, but there's a lot of lack of clarity around that. A big famous example of this was the Ukraine hold that was tied up in the Trump impeachment involved apportionment, but that is by no means the only example. And you know, the questions about transparency, the idea is, to the extent that these apportionments coming from OMB are actually conditioning how funds may be used, it should be public that there was that kind of role for OMB. And then Ilya asked, well, what about backroom? You know, is sometimes backroom better? I think there's really strong arguments that backroom dealing is really important for compromise in Congress. So a committee back room or members of Congress who are compromising, we're talking about situations where Congress has decided how the money should be spent. And the agency that's responsible for spending it probably wants to spend it. And we're adding in just like this inter spot where there's a potential source of power. So really it isolates on this question of, do you want the presidency to get to have extra power between Congress and the agency in this space? And that's where it's one of those areas where you kind of isolate for reducing presidential power, bringing back congressional power by just requiring transparency around the use of that device.
I'm a little bit betwixt and between on this one, because from my perspective, Professor Lawrence, I know the committee, particularly the appropriation committees, are staff are can and do look at the apportionments. I know that the congressional power of the PURSE Act that's being proposed recommends or has a section in it that says that we're going to have these apportionments published in the Federal Reserve, Federal Register, and that it's going to make it all public. Quite frankly, I wonder just how many of the, quote, average person outside the Beltway here would look at the Federal Register in terms of the apportionment process or even understand what it means. But who would look at it would certainly be those particular advocates of those programs that are being apportioned. And then that creates a new round of a pressure placed upon the congressional leaders who did it. I think that the apportionment process, you already mentioned it clearly, the Anti-Deficiency Act, what even though it was finally caught by on terms of the Ukraine money that President Trump essentially did not apportion at all until it became clear he was being caught. It seems to me that it's an interesting proposal, but I'm not sure it would change matters that much.
All right, we have a question from Kurt Couchman. Well, he has two. I'm going to take them out of order. Could the Congressional Budget Act separation of the discretionary spending process for managing direct or mandatory spending and revenue have contributed to today's dysfunction? So, Bill, go ahead and explain that. I saw
that question, and I thought that's a very good question, Kurt, because my perspective on this is that once we established what we call discretionary caps 10 years ago, 2011 legislation, when we did it again, we were faced with the government shutdown. We had this great super committee. We're going to work it all out. And we ended up essentially establishing these caps. We established these caps on basically one third of the federal budget. And it's that other two thirds that are the real tough ones in terms of political will. And that is are the entitlement programs, the mandatory programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, farm price support, student loans. By putting those caps in, I would take Kurt's position here that by putting those caps in on discretionary spending, you're basically saying, we could go home and say we're controlling federal spending by controlling one third of spending. Well, those were the programs that most people in the American public look to. That's transportation, that's infrastructure, that's science, that's technology, that's education, that's TSA, that's Small Business Administration, that's the water and sewer, that's the Agricultural Research Service. Those are the programs that people think about usually when they think about government, and those are the ones that were squeezed throughout the last decade, which I think created, and shall I also say, the Public Health Service. Those are the programs that most people, I think of when they think of the federal government, not, oh, my Social Security bill, that's not a federal. Well, it is. And it's something that I think the division there made it such that you were not really focusing on the real issues. If you were concerned about debt and deficits, you were not focusing on the real problems that were creating debt and deficits going forward, if you're not willing to consider raising taxes. So I think Kurt's absolutely correct. I think that those caps, well, again, apologize, I probably agreed to go along with them at a staff level with the members. I do think it was part of the problem that created some of the polarization that we've seen over the last 10 years, particularly.
I think another way in which the distinction between discretionary and mandatory spending has manifested itself in the current process as dysfunction has to do with the reconciliation process and the degree to which the reconciliation process is used to make changes to mandatory but not to discretionary spending. And because the reconciliation process is protected from a filibuster, that really sort of incentivizes what change in one kind of spending. And if you, as I think we saw quite on display quite extensively in the American Rescue Plan this spring, if you sort of want to make certain changes through the reconciliation process, you end up having to kind of contort yourself and the spending and the program into the box that's permitted through the reconciliation process. And that's just not an especially healthy, it's not an especially healthy way to legislate. It doesn't give you all of the sort of degrees of freedom, all of the flexibility that you would, I think, prefer if you were trying to legislate most flexibly.
Someone be able to explain the power of the PURSE Act and whether you're in favor of it, whether you think it's a good idea, or could be you know, parts of it or what have you, because that's been bandied about and it seems like an important thing that's going to be with us in part for a while.
I think I'd like to defer to Molly since she's the one who's testified.
Sure, I'm happy to give sort of a high level overview. So it is legislation that would do a couple of sort of general things. So one is again around impoundment reform and attempts to prevent impoundment by the president. So here we're talking about things like apportionment reform and making apportionments public, like we were talking about before, providing sort of certain notification requirements for Congress, requirements on GAO and the Comptroller General address, as I think Bill was talking about before, penalties for not complying with the Impoundment Control Act. The second title has to do with transparency and things like reporting expired balances as part of the president's budget, reporting sort of cancellations and that sort of thing. There's also, again, efforts to strengthen congressional capacity in things like the Government Accountability Office, as well as publishing budget appropriations law opinions from, say, the Office of Legal Counsel. And then the third primary element of the power of the PURSE Act involves emergency spending, which I think both Bill and Matt alluded to in their comments at various points. Basically just trying to improve Congress's ability to check the president's use of the National Emergencies Act to spend beyond Congress's intent.
I'll just add to that great explanation with maybe a like one word version of the something that's going on in that proposed legislation. Ilya, if you're in, viewers might be familiar with the concept of departmentalism, that the law and the Constitution might be interpreted not by the courts, but the executive branch could interpret the Constitution and the law, and maybe the legislative branch could interpret for itself. And we generally don't have departmentalism, but oddly, we sort of do have it when it comes to spending, the power of the purse, the area that Madison and the framers were really concerned Congress should have the power of the purse. We have a number of places where actually interpretations of the laws that Congress writes for appropriations, for when you can spend, when you can't spend, how you can't spend, they're interpreted by OMB perhaps, by OLC, by agencies. And they're not only interpreted there and it kind of stops there, but often we don't even see the interpretations. OLC may not publish its interpretations of Appropriations Act that Congress wrote or something. There's concern that's a problem because it risks abuse, like perhaps the Ukraine example, or people following the Biden administration closely would surely find examples they were concerned about. The GAO exists to be able to kind of monitor, investigate, but for another distinction, there is sort of a fire alarm investigation model. If somebody spots something and is concerned, they can investigate, but it's not monitoring. We don't know the day-to-day. We don't have like an audit of what's kind of happened. And that's true too of the appropriations committees that if someone has a concern, maybe it gets looked into, but that creates this whole huge space where the executive branch has laws governing spending that it's interpreting itself, and we don't know what's happening necessarily. And that power of the purse legislation includes a number of measures, publishing OLC opinions, providing transparency around these apportionments, and also empowering GAO to be more involved in oversight that would not take the interpretations away from the executive branch, but bring transparency to the interpretations it was making. So so there would be at least an ability to see if there were bigger problems there going forward. So that's that legislation. And I mentioned that it's folded into the Protecting Our Democracy Act that the Rules Committee pushed forward, I think yesterday, the day before or something, which is why I think it's on people's minds.
I should note that my wife works for the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, but I have no idea whether she's working on any budget-related issues. What about presidential flexibility, right? Someone who's a big Article II person would say, you know, what you're saying about agencies and, you know, that they want more and more budgets and they're hiding this stuff and the Chevron deference, oh, that's all well and good. But what about the president himself who has... not emergencies, but also just, you know, we have a dysfunctional Congress that doesn't legislate. And after all, the president is involved in presidential administration, this term, you know, that's the title of a famous Law Review article by now Justice Kagan, right? It's the executive branch and specifically the president, the office of the president and the president himself drive so much of policy these days. And with a dysfunctional Congress that doesn't legislate, you know, on budgeting probably legislates more than on anything else because it has to pass a budget at the end of the day. Won't all of these reforms, you know, prevent that kind of flexibility that given you're not going to be solving the rest of Congress in one fell swoop just by solving the budgeting process that the president or the executive branch needs?
If I can give a quick answer, I think that there's often a trade-off between flexibility of the executive and stability or order or regularity. But sometimes that trade-off is false. And it's particularly false where our current way of doing things, not transparent, secretive, but also hostage-taking or emergent, where our current way of doing things for the executive undermines the capacity of the executive, both in the short term and the long term, to be very effective at governing. So it can do something it wants, but that thing doesn't hold up in court if it's challenged, or that thing is extremely controversial. And so actually over time, over the years, when the executive acts, it's less and less able to just accomplish things it wants to accomplish. I think that this is one of those areas where there is a tension between the short run power of the executive to just be able to do what it wants, and transparency would reduce our ability to do what we want and things like that. And the long-term capacity of the executive, I think you see over time a dilution of the ability of the executive to accomplish things successfully. And even if you look at the wall construction, there was executive authorities that got wall money allocated, but a wall was not built. And there is now executive things about the wall, but things aren't exactly happening exactly as the Biden administration would want. And so the short version of my now rambling answer is that an additional variable, in addition to the flexibility of the executive, and that's also implicated by stability, is the competence and capacity of the executive. And sometimes those old ways of doing things they came up with, rule of law, regular order, actually promote a very competent, effective executive that would be more energetic within the space that it's been given.
So the what I would add here is that in addition to, so a number of the sort of elements of the Power of the Purse Act and several things we've been talking about are about increasing Congress's ability to oversee the executive. But I think generally trying to increase Congress's capacity to complete its appropriations work in a timely and effective manner is something that would be good for the executive branch. So the senator talked a fair amount about how costly even planning for a possible government shutdown is for federal agencies. And you know, having to go through all of the hoops to say, these employees are gonna be accepted and these employees are not, and kind of preparing for an orderly wind down that then never actually comes to pass because Congress passes a continuing resolution at the last minute. Just in general, trying to improve Congress's ability to legislate in the appropriations space, I think is, in the end, a good thing for the executive branch.
I can't add to Professor Lawrence and Dr. Reynolds' comments. I find it somewhat ironic that we're talking about this in the context of the 1974 Congressional Budget Power and Control Act, because that was exactly why the 1974 Congressional Budget Power and Control Act came into existence. We had a president, as some of you might remember, a book was reading, The Imperial Presidency, that basically took over and had all the flexibility he wanted, and he didn't care about what Congress had to say. Maybe we've come full circle here, and it's time to go back. But listen, I think the president has rights under the Article II. They're specified, they're clear. I'm not a lawyer. I'm speaking here to constitutional lawyers. I shouldn't go any further, but the bottom line is, I just think that there is Article I and there is Article II, and the two of them have to work in the Constitution in a way that makes this government function the best it can. And I like the ideas that both Molly and Professor Lawrence have put forward, that having those rules at least may in the long run make a more efficient and effective executive branch.
Well, that's, I think, a good segue into a question posed in the chat by Raquel Spencer, who asks whether panelists could speak to the effectiveness of relying on litigation to resolve funding disputes between the Congress and the executive. We saw that in the emergency context with the wall. We see it from time to time, increasingly, it seems, with different kinds of appropriations. It also touches on Chevron deference and the non-delegation doctrine, whether that's coming back. But anyway, litigation between Congress and the executive, is that a good thing, a bad thing? Does it help our rule of law? Does it help keep the budget process or move the budget process back to what it should be?
So I'll say that but I, in the context of funding disputes and more generally, I think relying on litigation, particularly if you are Congress and you are trying to use litigation to get the executive branch to do something that they do not want to do, that is often a losing proposition simply because of how long it takes to resolve itself. And so we can see some of these examples in the context of funding, but we can see it in lots of other examples too. And certainly in the context of emerging and ongoing disputes about requests for information from the House regarding what happened on January 6th at the Capitol. You're absolutely right, Ilya, that there are more of these across the board that are emerging. And one lesson for me from all of them is that they, even when the courts claim that they are moving quickly, it still takes quite a long time to use this particular avenue to try and resolve a dispute. And so I think generally it is, if Congress is trying to get what it wants, it is not the most effective or expeditious way for it to do so.
I'll just ditto that the inherent uncertainty of litigation just makes it, it's not that it's not an extremely useful tool, but it makes it a challenging tool. And I'll add two things. First, Raquel, who asked the question, I worked with at the budget committee when I was a special legal advisor there, so in full disclosure. But secondly, uncertainty, I think, is particularly problematic when we're dealing with these cliffs, like shutdowns and debt ceilings. It seems to me that the more uncertainty there is about the deadline and what will happen if the deadline is reached, the more likely it is we'll get there. And when you add in litigation, you add question marks about, is that actually the deadline? If we hit the debt ceiling, but then the Supreme Court ruled something, maybe we wouldn't hit the debt ceiling. All of a sudden votes start to change or something like that. So that uncertainty of litigation is particularly problematic for that reason. On the other hand, courts are essential at establishing rules and kind of enforcing them. But I think here it's how can courts be used to influence the ex ante behavior, the upstream behavior of people in government. And that's one place where penalties, whether they're criminal or civil, could come in.
Do you think, and I'll ask this of Matt because he's the law professor, how much of this is a political question? What should courts do with some of these disputes? Should they conversely find very little to be a political question and, you know, try to apply legal standards? What would be helpful here?
I'm going to try to give a short answer. That's a great question, Ilya. I think the first thing courts should do is to provide predictability, upstream predictability, so that they should approach these questions in a way that makes it easier for all involved to know what they'll say, what courts will say at the end of the day, which is another way of saying they should make it easy to know what the law is in these spaces. So there's sometimes statutory interpretation rules, clear statement rules that make things more clear. That's a good thing, I think, in this space. And then there's sometimes statutory interpretation rules that make things less clear. I think that's potentially problematic. That said, and although courts are inherently unpredictable, I think that it's calling something a political question and staying out of it is very dangerous because it's telling the upstream actors that there's no law there. It often happens, I think, in government, and it's problematic, that a court adopts a standard and says, we're not going to scrutinize that, or it's a political question because we don't know the answers. And the effect of that judgment upstream is that the lawyers aren't invited to the meeting and no one even looks at the law. And that's not what you want. Even Chevron deference, you could sometimes say, there's questions sometimes with Chevron deference. Well, how closely are we adhering to the law? And are we risking agencies being more willing to forget about the law or something like that, which is a problem? So I think it's a difficult thing for courts because first, like I said, uncertainty is very bad. You want to have predictable rules that people know what they are and can predict them. I think predictability is always important to courts, but especially so here. And then second, you don't want to opt out because you want to make sure that the law is still influencing the upstream behavior. And I'm going to run out of space on my screen, but courts come at the end of the process. The stage before that is the executive branch. You want them thinking about what the courts will say the law is. And the reason you want that ultimately is because who wrote the law? Congress, the people that the framers said are supposed to decide about spending and appropriations among many other things. And that whole system breaks down if at the end of it, courts aren't expected to be there, but they do have to exercise that role very carefully.
I will turn to another question from Kurt Couchman, and this is currently the last question in the chat, but that's okay. We're kind of getting to the bottom of the hour. So Kurt asks, the federal government is more similar in structure to the states than to other countries. What are some lessons or best practices that Congress can learn from the states? Has anyone looked at this?
There's an excellent paper by David Gamage and last name of Look, L-O-U-K, on shutdowns that looks to states and kind of does a something like a 50-state survey that I would suggest to the commenter. One challenge is that states can't borrow. For the most part, they're constitutionally constrained not to be able to borrow. And there's also other reasons they can't borrow. So this power to spend against our future and make investments in ourselves as a country and hope we'll recoup the investments, that power to deficit spend is limited to the federal government. And so many of these issues about how to make trade-offs between taxing, spending, and borrowing don't apply to states in the same way.
So in addition to Senator Lankford's constitutional amendment to dissolve Congress if it doesn't appropriate, we now have Professor Lawrence's endorsement of the balanced budget amendment. Fantastic.
I was gonna add that I agree that the one thing you could look to in the states, that is their state constitutional requirements in terms of balanced budget, because they can't borrow. But I think we can't, I am not a constitutional balanced budget proponent, because I do think the federal government needs the flexibility in times of war, in times of recession, times of pandemics, to be able to spend beyond that which it has resources for the good of the country. But I do think there is something we can learn from the states as it relates to their formulation of their budget, and that has to do with their capital budgets versus their, I do think there's an argument that could be made that the federal government putting everything in the same pot as it relates to expenditures and not differentiating between investments that may benefit the long run, such as infrastructure investment, roads, highways, education, public health systems. I do think that there is an argument that can be made that the states have a way of doing this in a way that the federal government might learn to change its way it budgets for those kinds of expenditures differently.
All right, looks like we have time for one late breaking question that just came in from Saren Lindengren Savage, who asks, similar reforms to the National Emergencies Act have been included in legislation introduced in the past by Senators Lee, Murphy, Leahy, and others. It seems to have bipartisan support, but no urgency, which is ironic given that it's reforming emergency actions. What is stopping the Biden administration or a future administration from declaring a climate emergency or some other emergency and using it to move money away from what Congress appropriated it for? Quick cut on the National Emergencies Act reform.
I'll do a very quick. There is a paper on climate change as national emergency by Mark Nevitt, N-E-V-I-T-T, for readers who are interested in that. And I can't really speak to the political urgency kind of questions, but one thing I'm curious about as a political observer is, as we get into the primaries for midterms for 2022, and then the primaries for 2024, whether or not this becomes an issue in the Republican side campaign of whether or not candidates distinguish themselves by supporting or not different reforms to the way the presidency operates.
It's one thing to declare a national emergency. It's another thing to have the funds to carry out that national emergency. It still goes back to the Congress having the power of the purse to appropriate the monies necessary to carry out that national emergency.
That's a good note to end on, I think. I'll turn it back to Nate Kaczmarek. And thanks, Nate, for having all of us. I certainly learned something, and I hope those in the audience did as well.
Yes, I've learned a lot as well. I think it's been excellent. One parting announcement for our audience is that this year's Article 1 Initiative Writing Contest is devoted to a similar theme to our discussion today. The contest title is Congress and the Power of the Purse, Is It Lost to History? You can learn more about that contest by visiting our website. I think the deadline is the beginning of next month. First prize is $7,000. So trying to encourage a lot of good thought and new ideas on this front, of course. I think today has been very informative, and we're really grateful to Molly, Bill, Matt, and Ilya. We certainly welcome feedback on the program via email at articlei@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. Have a great one.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article 1 Initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.